Good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name's Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm joined by our co-host, Mona Hill.
Hello, everyone.
And we have very special guests today from the Provincial Association of Transition Houses and Services of Saskatchewan. We have Diane Delaney, who is the coordinator. Welcome, Diane.
Hello.
And we have Crystal Giesbrecht-Fletcher, the Director of Member Programs and Services of PATHS.
Hello.
Welcome all.
Both of you. And PATHS, again, is the Provincial Association of Transition Houses and Services of Saskatchewan. So welcome, ladies. One thing I'd like to do before we get into this conversation is I have a couple of community announcements to make. So I'm going to do that now, and then I'll actually repeat them, I think, at the end of the program. They're both very important. The first one is, considering that this is sort of a female-based show today, I also want to make an announcement about the fact that all month long in September is Ovarian Cancer Month. And Ovarian Cancer Month includes also awareness of all gynecologic cancers, including cervical, uterine, endometrial, fallopian, vulvar, and ovarian cancers. They're all challenging to diagnose, but they're not silent anymore. And some doctors do need upgrading in information, and that the Pap test does not detect ovarian cancer. This is a very important factor. We've actually had OCATS, which is the local Saskatchewan organization of ovarian cancers in Saskatchewan, on a show in the past. And this is something they talked about the fact that there are doctors who still do not understand that the Pap test does not detect ovarian cancer. So what's coming up where you can get involved? There's going to be a mini ovarian cancer walk this Sunday coming on September 11th in the Lady Slipper Courtyard at Wascana Park. And it'll be happening at noon. There will be entertaining, and Dr. Al Heike will be speaking. And the walk starts at 1 o'clock after, I guess, she speaks. And you can walk as far as you like. You can walk around the block if you like. And there's a registration of $25. And this will help to support money for funding for some of the work that OCATS is doing, which is incredibly important. If you want more information or you would like to register to attend this event, it's on Sunday afternoon at noon. You can call 584-3450. In Regina, that's 584-3450. The next announcement is very exciting for us here at Amnesty, and I might add that Crystal is also a member of Amnesty International, and we are really excited to announce that September 30th to October 1st in Saskatoon at the University of Saskatchewan, we will have our Amnesty International Fall Regional Conference. The Amnesty International Saskatoon and the U of S group will be hosting a regional amnesty conference, and the theme will be the rights of Indigenous peoples. There will be panel speakers and workshops. They'll touch on human rights abuses of Indigenous peoples in Canada, as well as countries across the world, countries such as Nigeria, Colombia, and Palestine. So on September 30th at 7 o'clock, there will be a documentary showing, and the main conference starts the next morning at 10 a.m. with registration starting at 9:30. There will be a panel discussion in the morning with panel members such as Dr. Priscilla Settee, who is the Professor of Native Studies at the University of Saskatchewan. I'll say a Professor of Native Studies. And Craig Benjamin, who is a longtime worker with Amnesty in Canada. He's part of the Campaign for the Rights of Indigenous Peoples for Amnesty Canada. And in the afternoon, after a provided lunch, there will be workshops going into further details on the rights of Indigenous peoples issues in countries around the world. And we will learn how we can take action to make a difference in supporting and advocating advocating with people around the world who suffer oppression because of being indigenous. And the registration for that is a mere $20. If you want more information, you can contact me. If you want to call me at 586-1938, I'm Mona Hill. Or you can contact me by email at MORDENROSE. That's Morgan Rose at hotmail.com. And I'll be talking about this over the next few weeks as well. So now we're done that community stuff. Let's go back to some more really important community stuff, which is the Provincial Association of Transition Houses and Services of Canada. Diane Delaney, take it away. What would you like us to know about the transition houses to start with? Give us a little bit of background on where this came from. Why do we need transition houses for women? What's it all about?
Well, they started in the mid-70s when women, you know, we had the consciousness-raising groups and those sorts of things happening. And women were becoming aware of the experiences of other women, many of them being abused in relationships and their marriages. And women wanting to respond to that, and one of the responses was to create the women's shelters so women would have safe places to go. And that's how it started. And then as they grew across the province, we felt the need to have provincial associations to support the individual members, shelter members in each province. And so we have provincial associations across the country. Every province has an association. Well, New Brunswick is kind of in a different little situation there. And then we also have an emerging network in the north that's coming together. And in fact, we, week after next, are all meeting in Yellowknife, all the provincial coordinators and the shelter directors from the shelters in northern Canada are coming together.
What do you hope to accomplish at your conference?
Because our national network is just beginning, so we're trying to determine our structure, and I've been working on that as well. And we're very lucky to be able to put this national organization together at this point. We've received funding from Status of Women Canada to be able to do this. So, and we've accomplished a lot so far, and Crystal can talk about one of the projects she's working on for the national organization. But in Yellowknife in particular, I think one of the things that's going to happen, other than we're going to formalize the organization, is we're going to have dialogue with the shelter directors from the north so that we can learn about their experience of being a shelter director in extremely remote communities and the challenges they face with that, which are, you know, underfunding. They depend on, you know, federal support from Indian and Northern Affairs, which has changed its name, and I can't remember what it is now.
Yes, it's no longer INAC.
Yeah.
Probably the Ministry of... something like that.
Right. I can't recall now.
Okay.
And, you know, the transportation issues of getting women to safe places.
Right.
And so we'll be talking about those kinds of things and maybe coming up with a plan in terms of how we as a national organization can support probably our most challenged shelters in the country and what we can do with a national voice around that.
Okay. As you're speaking, there's a lot of questions popping up in my mind. One of the things that pop, of course, is a current issue is the housing crisis, particularly in Saskatchewan. And I would imagine in the north also there would be, that would be one of the particular problems that you might not have to deal with in other places in the country. Where there is not really too much of a lack of housing. How has the housing crisis, say, in Saskatchewan been impacted? Or how has it impacted women in danger like this?
Mm-hmm. It's had a really serious impact in a lot of ways. Women are actually staying in relationships because they know they're not going to be able to find another place to live. And Saskatchewan has one of the worst housing situations in the country. There was a report done by the Salvation Army National Office, and which indicated that. And it's because we're, you know, kind of economically strong right now, but people, there are people who get left out when those kinds of things happen,
right.
And it's the women who've experienced violence are one of
right.
those groups.
And, you know, I've, in my personal work, been made very, very aware of that because of women who have entered a program that I work in. Who've had to leave the program because they've become homeless, and some of them have children, or they're living in situations that are unhealthy, like you say, and how much that impacts the rest of their life and their learning skills and ability to focus in any kind of programming, lack of health of care for their children as well. So it's pretty big, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's like we have sort of two classes of citizens in a way, you know, ones that can afford housing and all other kinds of things as well, and then others mm-hmm. that are in situations where they don't have that.
Right. But and then let's take this to another level of women who can afford housing and women who maybe have some decent work and have what we would call an average family in our society, who end up going through abuse, because it's not just about women living in poverty who are abused, is it?
Right. No, that's true. Although we do find there's evidence that shows the more equality there is in a relationship, the less likely there is to be abuse,
mm-hmm.
Both at the individual level and in society systemically. So when you have more equal societies, you're less likely to see women being abused. But that's not to say that women who don't have, you know, economic advantage aren't necessarily experiencing violence. We're not seeing them at the shelters, which is a bit of a concern to me, because you do hear then of situations that women have gotten them that's mm-hmm. happened to them, when maybe if they had accessed the shelter they would have been safe, but they're not perhaps seeing that as an option for themselves, mm-hmm. And that might be something that we need to look at a little further.
Right. And you talk about equality and you mentioned economics, so that would be one aspect of the equality that might lead to a better opportunity to deal with something like that, or maybe not suffer as much of it when you have that type of equality. What about something like if you have an education, how does that impact your ability to stay out of that type of situation or to deal with it on the whole if you're living in a situation like that?
Yeah, I mean, you have more options. You know, if you have a good education, you can get a better job and have a higher income, you know, afford the higher rents that we're experiencing right now. So I think it just gives you more choices when you have that economic stability. So that's one of the things we advocate for, too, as a provincial association, is a guaranteed income. That's one of our positions that we take. So acknowledging how important that is, that we live in a society based on the values of equality.
Right. The other thing that I thought was very interesting was in the past, I know that there have been attempts to maybe help women to stay in their home. At one point, I remember there, years and years ago, there became a sort of a hue and cry as to when a woman is being abused, why is it she who has to leave the home? Why is it the children who have to leave the home? Why do they have to leave their stability on top of being victimized? And then their abusers end up being able to stay in the home, have the comfort of the home. And then there were sort of some changes being made in that area. Could you touch on this and sort of where are we at with this now? Because the fact that we still need transition houses, the fact that we need safe houses, speaks to the fact, in my opinion, that maybe we haven't gotten that far.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Like, how far have we gotten? Wow, that's just really big. But
we have a whole hour.
Okay, yeah.
Well, we got to get Crystal in, too.
Absolutely. And so I was wondering, maybe just in terms of the practical reality of women having access to their homes, maybe Crystal wants to speak to that a bit, because we have the domestic violence intervention orders. And Crystal works in a shelter, actually.
Okay.
She not only works with me, but she works in a shelter. So I'll let her maybe look at that kind of individual situation.
Go ahead.
And,
Sure. Ask me the question again, because I don't want to start talking too broadly.
It is a fairly broad question, and maybe I should apologize
for
that.
That's okay. I just want to narrow it down so I don't.
Yeah, so narrowing it down would be, why are women expected still in this day and age, after we've been working and working on protecting women, why are they still forced to leave their homes? Why can't they stay in their home? Why can't the perpetrators be taken out of their home? Why can't the women be protected in their home? And the children being forced to leave and being forced to change schools. I mean, this creates such a myriad of problems, not only for the women, but of course we know for the whole family system, the breakdown of it, just because the abuser ends up getting to stay in the house and the rest don't.
I think, and this is a bit of my personal opinion from my personal experience, working casual in Regina Transition House, but I think one thing is women don't know. They can access things like emergency intervention orders. When we do intake with clients, we always ask them, how was your experience with the police? Were the police helpful? Did they offer you an emergency intervention order? And then the next question is, do you know what one is? And a lot of times the women don't. And then later on, when we're done the intake process, we explain that to them. And we also refer them often to domestic violence outreach at Family Service Regina, who helps women navigate a lot of that legal stuff. But I think they don't know that that's an option. Women think to be safe, they have to leave. They don't realize that he can legally be made to not have access to the home for whatever period of time.
Would this count someone who's perhaps, let's say they're a homeowner, just say, or their name is on the lease. Joe Smith's name is on the lease. He's the one doing the abusing, or even if it's a female partner and the abuser has the power that way, can they still create an order to keep them away from the home?
I believe you can if it's a common law relationship. You know, if it's you also have a right, the two of you live in the home together, and an order like that is a temporary thing until you have court and you make whatever kind of arrangements or the judge comes to a decision. It's a temporary fix so that the woman and possibly her children don't have to run and try and find shelter or find somewhere to stay.
Right.
It's a temporary thing to kind of keep that stability for the family.
Okay. And you got a program for mentorship for these women, don't you? Is
yes.
that okay? Do you want to talk about that now? Or, Diane, did you want to mention some more stuff on your behalf?
No, I think that's...
Yeah, we can go right into this and talk about
this. Yeah, the modeling and mentoring program ties in. This is something that PATHS is doing in partnership with Regina Transition House. And it's a project funded by the Status of Women Canada. And this is something that was designed in 2010, and it came out of recommendations from Transition House's outreach program. They did an evaluation with clients who were accessing outreach, and what the women were saying was that they wanted support and mentorship from someone who'd been there, talking to their counselor or the domestic violence counselor or social worker in the shelter is one thing, but they wanted someone who'd been there and lived that experience. So that's how this idea came to be, and PATHS partnered with Transition House on it, as it fits really well under PATHS' umbrella of services. So the goal of the project is to match a woman who's previously experienced intimate partner violence with a woman who's just leaving the shelter, match them up in a supportive relationship so the woman feels reduced. She doesn't feel as isolated. She's got support. Gives a feeling of empowerment to both partners, actually, because someone who's been there now gets to use their experience for positive and help the person who's just leaving the shelter. And both women get to be a support to each other. So that's something that we are trying to set up at this time. And we want to match women. They'll spend about 5 to 10 hours a month together, going out for coffee, taking a walk around the lake, doing whatever. But there's the support of the program coordinator there for them, so they can. There's regular check-ins, and they can call if there's a problem and work through things. And there's also some group activities, sharing circles and leadership things that we're going to be setting up for those women as well. So right now we're trying to recruit women for this. So if you have any listeners who have previously experienced intimate partner violence and would be interested in working in a mentoring relationship with a woman who's just leaving shelter, we definitely want to hear from them. We're really trying to get more women involved in this. I think it's a really excellent program.
Is there any type of training involved?
No, what we do is an orientation session. So it's a few hours in the evening where we go through confidentiality, the role of a mentor, the role of the mentee, what is and is not your role, and go through some role plays and some scenarios, but it's just an mm-hmm. evening or a Saturday kind
yeah.
of thing.
Okay.
So if there is anyone listening who's interested in the program, we would really like to hear from them. And the information about this is on PADS website, which is www.abusehelplines.org, or they can also call Regina Transition House and speak to Kim, who is the program coordinator for the modeling and mentoring program, and that's 757-2096 extension 227.
How many mentors are you looking for?
Our goal is to have 40 women in matches.
And is that in Regina alone?
That was our original goal, and what we planned to do was pilot this in Regina alone for 2 years and then take what we learned and spread it throughout the province. We've only been into this for not quite a year, or just over a year, and we decided that now was a good time to share it because all the research is done, the program's developed. It's just a matter of getting those women involved. So we have now just got some of our other member shelters around the province involved. So what we'll do is get them started recruiting, but really as many matches as we can get across the province. That's what we want. This is a really positive thing for women, and people who have signed up so far are seeing it as a positive thing. It's just that we need to get the word out to more people.
Okay, this sounds really good. Do you have any mentors yet?
We have a few who are actively matched and a couple others who are waiting for a match. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a matchmaking process where it's not always on a first-come, first-serve basis because you match people by ages of their children and personality characteristics.
Okay.
And so
I was going to say, we have some criteria here that we would have to be aware of.
The criteria to sign up is basically that the person has experienced violence in the past but currently is living a life free from violence. They have the time to volunteer and they're interested in doing that, and that they're physically safe, not in a violent relationship or, you know, a precarious situation if they're spending time with their mentor. But other than that, no. And then we just find out more about the woman and kind of match her with someone who she's got similar characteristics with, who we think they'd hit it off.
Okay. And what kind of success have you had thus far with your mentors and your mentorees?
Good so far. Positive feedback from the ones who are matched, but it's so early to tell. We don't have very many matches. Mm-hmm. So we'll be evaluating as we go, and then we can make improvements to the program. But
And what about, you talked about it sort of turning into a provincial-wide program. Which other communities would you be looking for mentors from where there are safe houses or transition houses? Or like, how many do we have that we're talking about here?
We've recently shared this information, and it's as far as training a program coordinator in Saskatoon, PA, Moose Jaw, Yorkton.
Meadow Lake.
Thank you.
Okay.
So we've just trained them to be program coordinators in their communities, and they'll hopefully be able to start recruiting mentors right away. And PATHS does have member agencies across the province, so maybe at some point we can get more of those agencies involved as well.
Okay. How much time have we got left, Jim?
Oh, about 2 minutes.
So I have one more question until the break. Is this a pilot project across the country? Is this the first pilot project, or are they doing this in other provinces up north? Or
no, actually, this is something, the idea came from Regina Transition House's outreach program. And when they did the research on this, they couldn't find anything similar. So the idea came from other peer-to-peer mentoring things like you know, big brothers, big sisters, and just a lot of research of, but putting it together with what would work for women who've experienced intimate partner violence. Recently, we have found out there's a similar program in Alberta, but it's not the same as ours or to the same scale. So this idea was developed right here.
Right on. Breaking roads. Okay. Okay, I think probably what we'll do is we'll come back after the break and we'll talk more with Diane Delaney and Crystal Giesbrecht from PAS, which is the Provincial Association of Transition Houses and Services in Saskatchewan. We're talking about sort of the basic housing issues for women who are abused, and a modeling and mentoring program that provides supportive relationships and mentors for women who are experiencing violence. And before we leave, though, what do we got? A minute left. I have something else to announce here. Just cut me off when you need to, Jim.
Sure.
This weekend, there's something exciting happening in Regina. It's a one-day event that provides free goods and services and information and resource sharing to support the homeless and those at risk of being homeless in Regina. Why are we doing this? To address immediate and long-term needs of the homeless or at those at risk of becoming homeless, specifically those affected by the current affordable housing, or I would change it to unaffordable housing crisis. And it's occurring at 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. tomorrow, or Saturday, that's tomorrow, the 10th, right? Yeah. At Knox Metropolitan Church on Victoria and Lorne. This is a project of the Salvation Army Regina, Carmichael Outreach, Regina Qu'Appelle Health Region, Knox Met Church, Project People, Common Wheel, and Four Directions Healthcare, and NCCA. And currently, I don't know what that acronym
is. Central Community Association.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, and with that,
are we done? Okay, we'll be back.
Take nothing for granted. I leave no stone unturned. I have rebuilt these bridges that were foolishly burned. After careful observation, I can see I was blind. Now I found what really heals me, living heart over mind. Well, I don't care how you measure, there's always someone twice as smart. There's always someone more ambitious who will finish what you start. After much deliberation, I have left that race behind. Now I've found what really heals me, living heart over mind. No more chasing after dreams that were never really mine. No more running round in circles trying to walk a straight line. I have slowed down my step, and if I've fallen behind, I'm in rhythm with my nature, living heart over mind.
Through a little bit of collection of CDs we had this morning for some music for our break. And anybody recognize the singer there?
I was talking. Oh, was that Is that our Canadian songstress, songwriter, Shirley Eichhart?
You betcha.
Okay.
That's from 1996.
That's because that's my album.
1996, the Jazz Sessions, and Shirley actually did everything. She wrote and produced and directed and performed and all that good stuff. She's a very talented lady. Haven't heard much from her lately.
Not lately, no.
Anyway.
So we're back. We're back on Human Rights Radio. I'm Mona Hill, and I'm co-hosting with Jim Hutchings. We're here today to talk about transition houses for women and Services of Saskatchewan. And Dana Delaney is with us. She's a coordinator of PATHS in Regina. And Crystal Giesbrecht. Is it Giesbrecht Fletcher?
No, just Giesbrecht.
It's just Giesbrecht. I thought it was. Yeah, yeah. And Crystal is working with PATHS on a modeling and mentoring program for women who suffer abuse and their families. And we're having a wonderful conversation, and we're learning new things. And I would like to go back to the conversation maybe with Dana and talk about maybe touch a little bit, because there are people out there who are, of course, very aware that women, unfortunately, are, you know, the majority of people who go through any kind of partner abuse are generally women, but we also know that there are men who go through abuse, whether it be from a male partner or whether it be from a female partner of some sort. What kind of services are there for them?
Well, as we mentioned, we get asked that. We've been asked that since we started this whole business since the 70s. If we had a nickel for every time, we'd probably have a lot of money.
Yeah.
I think, and maybe one of the reasons we get asked that is that as women, we're seen as the caregiver, so, you know, to kind of supposed to look after everybody, but certainly our business is looking after women and their needs, women who've been abused. And the statistics all point clearly to the fact that women experience violence far more frequently than men do. The violence is more severe. When you look at the general social survey, sometimes it looks like there's maybe a little more equality, but there's some perhaps flaws in how the data is gathered around that. But also, what is clear from that data is that the abuse that women experience is more severe, often life-threatening, has more impact on their lives. They're more likely to be hospitalized. It happens in self-defense quite often, so it's in the context of them having been abused. So certainly, that's why we focus on the issue of women, and that women are more likely to be stalked than men, far more likely. And certainly any kind of homicide numbers are far more prevalent for women than it is for men. Not to say, I mean, if we have any shelter in the country, if a man phones in and he's experienced violence, we would certainly provide the same kind of response that we would to a woman, except to offer him a place to stay, because in our shelters they're only for women and children.
So what would that response be, barring the "you can come and stay here because it's a shelter for women"? What type of response is that?
Yeah, well, just, you know, in terms of what services might be available for him, you know, what he needs to do to respond in a crisis situation.
Okay.
What kind of supports he can get that are out
all
there.
Right.
And then you can access counseling over the phone. The domestic violence counselors.
Okay.
People often phone in and they don't want to come to the shelter. They just want to talk. Mm-hmm. If a man phoned, he can receive counseling over the phone.
Okay. And does that happen very often?
No.
No. I've never been working and had a man call.
Yeah,
but
yeah. And that's a whole other issue. You could do another whole show about that, about why men don't phone. Right?
Yeah, and I have to say, there may be issues around that, but I think the numbers aren't the same. So that would be, and as we were talking about earlier, I mean, men have access to resources and are often, you know, perhaps have better jobs,
right?
Better
finances. Maybe afford to stay in a hotel for the night or something, or for a week or something.
Yeah,
yeah. There's a whole myriad of questions and answers on that. You mentioned numbers earlier. What's the average number of stays that a woman will have in a transition house or a safe house before her life can, I guess, get a semblance of being settled and having some stability?
Yeah, I don't have that exact number. Certainly, we do. Maybe Crystal knows. We do see people coming back.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, a lot of women have been in more than once, and sometimes it's the same partner. Sometimes it's a different partner. But yeah, as far as actually like what the average is, I'm not sure.
That's
an interesting question.
I heard something in the past about it takes maybe up to 6 or 7 times before they can get to a point where they can maybe think more rationally about making the changes necessary to not be in a situation like that again. So that's the only number I know. I think it was about 6 or 7 times of leaving and going back and leaving and going back. And there's so many reasons why women do that. And that's something that I'm very well aware that a lot of people do not have an understanding of, is why would a woman go back into a situation where she's being abused in any way, shape, or form? What's wrong with them? What's wrong with that woman that she would do that, right? There's a lot of reasons.
Yeah, and that's certainly something that people ask. Sometimes seems like it's a bit of a mystery why you would go back to that. But certainly, the reasons, it's, a very emotional response. You know, they hope he's going to change. You know, they don't have the options. They want to stay for the children. They want the children to have a father. Kind of a range of things. But the other thing that's often happening with women, too, is they're just waiting for the right time, and they're planning. They're thinking about it. And they might wait 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then when they feel it's the right time and they're going to succeed, then they'll go.
Mm-hmm. And lack of other resources and other than a safe house. You can't stay in a safe house forever.
Right.
How long can you?
Usually about 6 weeks.
About 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to the housing crisis that we mentioned in the first half of the show. I'm familiar with, there is a sort of a housing unit here in Regina for women who end up homeless. You don't necessarily have to be in an abusive situation. And it started out as a temporary home, and it's become more of a permanent residence for women. And if you're not abused, you can also go there, because that's another issue we could talk about too if we have time, is where do you go if you just end up homeless without being in an abusive situation? How do you deal with that? And I guess to get back to my question is the average amount of time being spent is getting longer and longer. Consequently, you're getting a waiting list. And now we're even at a point where I know there are places that won't even take a name on the waiting list anymore. So there's a lot of women just SOL here, totally out of luck and living on the streets or living on couches, 3 children and mom sleeping in the living room on the floor of a home with maybe 6 or 7 people in it, and expecting mom to be able to maybe finish her education or to be able to get up and be fresh for work in the morning, getting the children to school. I could do this whole thing. So how do you respond to this?
Well, we just actually did our own research on this topic of the housing crisis in Saskatchewan, and I interviewed 35 women across the province who had experienced violence about their housing issues, and all these things were raised, and this overcrowding. I talked to one woman, 17 people in a 3-bedroom house, and these are not unusual circumstances.
Yeah. No, and they're becoming more common.
Yeah. Appalling rental conditions that no one should have to live with, that women are living with their children in these circumstances. And what struck me about it is the strength of these women, that they survive in spite of this somehow.
Right.
That they go on, although some of them were feeling extremely desperate to the point of feeling suicidal.
Right.
And very appreciative of the services that we have to offer in terms of the housing, and the second stage in particular, because in second stage they can stay longer. So they're very, very appreciative of
how those
supports.
How does one go from first stage to second stage in that situation?
Maybe Crystal wants to answer that one.
Well, there's 2 second stage shelters in Regina, and what you have to do basically is apply for the space. You might be put on a waiting list, and then there's an interview process, and you can get an apartment in the second stage, but there aren't the number of second stage apartments that there are for people leaving shelter.
How many are there approximately? Do you have any idea?
I believe about 10
That's
spaces.
All?
Well, there's 10 in at Sophia House, and then
another
Wish.
Yeah, another 4?
Yeah,
okay,
14.
Okay. Yeah.
And in the whole city?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, and you can stay in second stage up to a year. So there's going to be a lot of people that might be interested that put their names on the list, but their time in shelter ends, and they have to go look for a rental apartment because they're not getting in. It's a great thing for the people who use it, because when you're in second stage, there's counseling and supports and programming there. But, of course, this is a resource issue, right? Like, there just isn't enough spaces for the need.
Where does all your funding come from for these programs?
Well, the province doesn't fund second stage, so usually Sophia House is a standalone organization, so they do a lot of fundraising, and it's always amazes me, because I used to be the director there, that every year I would think, wow, we survived another year, but this, I must be coming up to 25 years now, so it's really quite amazing. The other second stages in the province are attached to the shelters, and they kind of use their existing resources to support the second stage.
So you need fundraising as well, finances to keep you going as well.
Yeah, our shelters, I have to say, and compared to other places in the country, are fairly generously funded. But they all do fundraising as well to kind of supplement what they do. But I have to, you know, give credit to the government for supporting the shelters in the province.
Do you take volunteers to work at your shelters?
PATH specifically doesn't have volunteers, but all of the shelters manage their own volunteers. Some do and some don't. It kind of depends on the programming, but often they'll have volunteers come in and entertain the children. So if the women have a sharing circle or a support group or a house meeting, volunteers can do a craft with the children or take them outside to play. So sometimes that. Volunteers are also useful to work at fundraising events. If there's an event in the community, volunteers sometimes help, like, do stuff around the house as far as cleaning or shredding paper and that kind of stuff. But every shelter sort of recruits volunteers as they need them.
Do you have any type of life skills programs at all for some of these women that come in that might need that? Is that part of the counseling process, or do you refer them to any kind of programming? Or?
Yeah, well, just in terms of, I'll let Crystal kind of answer most of that, but we do see as an essential part of component of the work that we do in every shelter across the province the need for sort of a follow-up worker or an outreach worker or somebody that works with women after they've left and kind of at least kind of refers them to these kinds of programs perhaps. So we have clearly identified that as a need and have conveyed that to the government. And some shelters do have government funding for that, or some may use their fundraising dollars for it. But Crystal can speak specifically about how it works.
It's for us, it's kind of a hard question to answer because we have 19 member agencies and they all have different amount of resources, different amount of staff, and they offer different programming. But some of the shelters have, like Diane was saying, an outreach worker. Some don't, but overall the staff work with women on basic life skills. So often, and of course this is different in every agency, but often when the women are in shelter, there's chores, right? So the women take turns cooking supper each night, doing things around the house. The staff are there for support. If a woman doesn't know how to cook something or wants to try something new, we do it side by side and help her do it. There's staff on board to help parents, help women with children with parenting skills. So it's kind of done not in such a formalized, you know, life skills class sort of way, but the staff are aware of those issues and kind of have the information to support the clients as needed. And as well, we do try and access things available in the community. So we refer women to parenting programs or employability skills training, those kinds of things, depending on the woman.
You were mentioning some of the support you get from the government in terms of funding. I was just wondering, we're coming up on election, and this might be an interesting question to ask them. What's their vision in this particular department? Where do they see things improving? How are they going to improve things? Do you have any conversations with government people? And what do they tell you? I'm just curious.
Yeah, they're really, in terms of the issue of violence against women, I think they're really quite engaged with that. I think they're sort of looking at the north a bit more. Mm-hmm. I think that might be a question to ask them in the context of the north of Saskatchewan.
Are they looking at it more in a law and order type context, or are they looking at trying to make things better for the victims?
Probably both. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that they're thinking about and are going to probably explore is, you know, the Aboriginal communities too, mm-hmm. and the high rates of violence that are experienced there, and certainly that impacts on women. Like mm-hmm. most of our clients are Aboriginal women.
One of the things I'd like to touch on as well is something that I've experienced in my past work is women with addictions. In the past, I don't know what it's like today, but in the past years, I was aware that women who were in a phase in their life where they were actively addicted to various substances would not have been welcomed in any type of transition house. And I'm wondering if there's been a change in that, or what type of support there is for a woman who is actively engaged in any kind of sort of habitual substance abuse, but needing safety as well. How do you deal with this currently?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question. We're currently working on our developing standards, like an actual written document with standards, and this has come up in terms of what kinds of support. And I think we want to have the standard across the province that we certainly accept women with addictions, mm-hmm. and would support them in any way we can. It's a communal living environment, right. So you always have to take that into consideration, right. And you don't want to jeopardize the other people staying there from, you know, problematic behavior, especially mm-hmm. when there's children around.
Exactly.
But I know what a lot of our shelters do if a woman comes in and she's used substances or alcohol, you know, they just tell her, go stay in your room till this wears off, and they kind of deal with it that way. I think that's the majority of the response, mm-hmm. although it might vary. But once we get our standards in place, we're going to be able to really look at this and make sure that we're providing the best service possible.
Right. And you might want to think about providing some sort of an addictions response program along with that as well. I think that might be something that would be valuable too.
Yeah, I know some shelters have tried that to some extent. I think part of the problem is it's a transient kind of situation.
Yes.
So we don't get people staying there long enough. Okay. And actually, when I worked at Isabel Johnson Shelter, we did a little survey with mm-hmm. the women and asked them, what is it you need from us? We did this over the course of a year. And we thought they might identify addictions, help with their children. No, that's not their priority. Their priority is to be safe and to have somebody to listen to them.
Uh-huh.
So this is what they're looking for when they come to us. And I think given that, that has to be our priority as well. Not to say we're not going to look at those other issues, but we have to hear what it is that they're looking for when they come to us.
Right. How much time, Jim?
Oh, we've got 7 minutes.
Okay, let's talk about the police. during the break, Crystal, you mentioned that you don't have too much contact with the police. But I think I'm really interested in maybe having a bit of a conversation, if possible, about community connection with police services and with the transition houses. Because somewhere along there's a process where someone perhaps phones the police because of a violent situation, and then they respond. And you mentioned in the first half of the program that they don't always get the information they need to make maybe good decisions for themselves, or to make decisions based on a knowledge-based decision, sort of. And the police are going to be sort of a mediator or a medium of some sort between yourself and the victim. So where is this going, or where has this been in the past?
Well, one thing you mentioned was people not getting the information. And that's a question of, you know, if the police come and intercept a very violent situation, it might be hard for them to sit down and say, now you have 7 options and let's go through them, right? So I don't know if that's a fault there, or maybe we need to be getting this information out to the women beforehand, so all the women in the community, and all the people in the community, yeah. rather, know what legal responses are there for them. But at PATHS, we don't have a lot of communication with the police, but one of our member agencies, the YWCA, does do presentations to the new recruits. So they talk about domestic violence mm-hmm. to the police, so they get that training there from frontline workers in the area, which is really positive. And in our shelters, we always do get a positive response from the police when we call them for assistance. We have to call them on occasion to do a police escort if it's not safe for a woman to return home and pack a bag and take her things. The police will go along with the staff and the woman to her home, and they're always more than willing to help out with that. And as well, if we ever have to make a missing persons report for a woman, we get a positive response from them.
Okay.
But again, I think it's an issue of getting more information out right. there, so people know before the crisis happens what they can do.
Right. And I maybe wouldn't be aware of this, but I'm wondering how often they force the perpetrator of the violence out of their home rather than the victims. Any ideas on that?
They're not using the emergency intervention orders as much as they used to.
I wonder why.
Yeah, that's probably something we've
And it might be because of the dual arrest policy mm-hmm. that's going on. If, you know, if the police show up and there's a violent situation, we don't really know who's at fault here. Both people
okay.
might get charged. Now, that doesn't happen all the time, but...
Okay. Yeah, there's always that risk as well. I mean, the other thing we have to think about is that we have to make sure women are safe. And sometimes
right.
if they stay in their home, they might not be safe.
Exactly.
So it's better for them to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
so I've always had that little bit of concern about
yeah.
the emergency intervention
yeah.
orders. While they can be useful, you mm-hmm. have to consider the women and children's
yeah. If a perpetrator doesn't want to play by the rules,
exactly.
they can still come around
exactly.
and stalking still takes place.
Right.
So sometimes hiding is a good thing for
yes,
safety.
Absolutely. And on that note, do they know, is it public, where the transition houses are located? Because I do know that there are people there who will stalk their victims.
Mostly they don't give the addresses out, but
mm-hmm.
some do.
Okay.
It varies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always surprised at how many people don't know where the shelter is.
Okay.
They've
yeah.
been around in the community for a long time,
mm-hmm.
so... You know, maybe you had a relative who stayed there 20 years ago kind
okay.
of thing. You might be able to find out where it is.
Right.
It is secret location,
yeah.
but you
yeah.
always do have those people that might be able
yeah.
to figure it
and
out.
And there is security measures being taken in the houses. And
oh,
that
absolutely.
Sort of thing. Yeah. Well, it's at last minute. What would you like to say to end this conversation today?
I just, you know, reflecting on the question that you asked earlier about have we made any progress, and that's something I ask myself all the time, and I really think we have, and I think we have to acknowledge that we have, the societal attitudes have changed. We still have the violence. I think we need to start asking new questions now,
mm-hmm.
and so that's a kind of a direction I think that we're going to be going in into the future, kind of looking at where we've come from, where we are, where do we need to go for the future and to really try to eliminate violence in our communities?
Thank you very much for being on our show. This has been Crystal Giesbrecht and Diane Delaney from PATHS, Provincial Association of Transition Houses of Saskatchewan. I remembered that.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a great show and very informative. Thank you so much for being here. And I have one announcement. Do I have time for that
sure.
1 minute? Okay,
because
I want to talk about what's happening. Is it Sunday? Where is it? Mini Ovarian Cancer Walk, September 11th, that would be Sunday, at the Lady Slipper Courtyard in Wascana Park at noon, with entertainment and Dr. L. Heike speaking about ovarian cancer, various types of cancers, gynecological cancers. And there will be a walk starting at 1. You can walk as far as you like, or just walk around the park once, or walk a half a block, whatever you like. And there's $25 to register. And for more information, you can call 584-3450. And take it away, Jim.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Every day and every moment in every corner of the world, injustice cries out for your intervention. To paraphrase a great humanitarian, if you can't help everybody, just help one. And whether the abuses stop immediately or take a long time to end, the gift of your attention and intervention can make a profound and positive impact on the ability of individuals and communities to endure and prevail. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."